Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania, it's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnton.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnzen, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Monday on this 21st day of November 2016. I'm delighted to have as a guest today for the very first time ever, Dr. Ian Clary, Research and Teaching Fellow for the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies, teacher at Redeemer University College, Heritage College and Seminary, and Munster Bible College, an associate pastor and elder at West Toronto Baptist Church. We're going to be following up on a topic we began last Wednesday with Bob Smart, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival, and the Reformed Tradition. Dr. Smart and Dr. Clary contributed to this book along with other authors. And today we are going to be picking up on Dr. Clary's contribution to this book, Melting the Ice of a Long Winter, Revival and Irish Descent. And it is my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. Ian H. Clary.
Thank you. Talking to you here from the very cold climate of Toronto, Ontario, and it's a real pleasure to be here on the show with you. Thank you.
Hey, it's my pleasure to have you on the program, and I'm very eagerly looking forward to getting into the subject at hand. But before we do that, I want to announce our email address. If anybody would like to join us on the air with questions, it's chrisarnzen@gmail.com, C-H-R-I-S. ARNZEN@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state of residence, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. And you may remain anonymous if it makes you feel more comfortable because of something you're asking that involves a personal and private matter, since we do have a pastor as a guest. But other than that, we would urge you to please at least identify yourself by name, city, state, and country. And that's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Before I even get into the subject at hand of Pentecostal outpourings, revival, and the Reformed tradition, I'd like to know something about your own personal background, how you came to faith in Jesus Christ, what the religious upbringing, if any, that you had was, and et cetera, if you could.
Yes, I would love to do that. Before I do, I do want to say that the pastor that I work with here in Toronto is actually from Westchester County in New York, and when he heard that I was on the show, he was quite excited about it because he used to go to hear debates that you, I guess, would set up with James White. And so when I told him I'm on the show, he thought I hit the big time. So I'm the lowly associate pastor, but I can wear some big shoes for a couple of days. I'm very, very happy to talk about how the Lord has worked in my life. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, which is right across the border on the Canadian side from Detroit, Michigan. So part of me is that my growing up, I've always had a certain affinity to the United States and felt sometimes more American than I did Canadian. But growing up in Windsor in a nominal Christian home, my mother at the time, she's a believer now, but at the time of my growing up, was a nominal Anglican, and my father a lapsed Catholic. And so I grew up in that period of time where the tail end in Canada where you would still recite the Lord's Prayer, where I can remember my grade 3 teacher, Mrs. Green, reading Bible stories to us in class, and so had some sort of a Christian sensibility about things, knew the basic stories of the Bible, but really did not, have any firm teaching of it in my home. We didn't regularly attend church. So it wasn't until I was 18 where after a life in high school of partying and doing stupid things teenagers do, that a friend of mine, who his father was a Baptist minister in Windsor, invited me up to a cottage in northern Ontario, where I heard the gospel really for the first time, and the Lord used him to draw me to Himself, and I can very clearly remember sitting around a campfire with this friend as he's sharing through the Gospel of John, telling me my sin and my need for a Savior, and the Lord just grabbing me and pulling me to Himself. Even though I'm 38 and I would have been about 18 at the time, so that's 20 years ago, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was a really, really precious time.
Well, praise God for that.
Yeah.
Well, when did you realize that God was giving you a call to become a pastor?
Well, it's both a hard and easy question to answer. I very early on in that, after my conversion, I had discerned some sense of a calling to ministry. I really didn't know what that looked like. And the friend that I mentioned who had shared the gospel with me, his dad had really pushed it on me that he thought he saw something that needed to be pursued. And so I had initially thought about going and getting training in Toronto at Tyndale University College and Seminary. And for whatever reason, I just had, even though I had signed up for that, I had real hesitations and ended up holding off, only to find out that Heritage College, which is a Baptist college in Cambridge, Ontario, was starting an extension center in my hometown of Windsor. So I started taking courses there, really having no idea what I was going to do, just exploring things. And very sadly, in the midst of all that, the friend who had led me to the Lord, his dad had, unfortunately, a moral failing in ministry, and that blew up the church, and the friend that led me to the Lord has abandoned the faith. And that really just put an even more fervent desire in me to really understand what I believed. And so through that early process of going to school and my friend losing his faith, and at the same time my parents separating, the Lord just really drove home into my heart things like His sovereignty, His love for me in the cross, and it was there that I had first encountered Reformed theology. And once I sort of started to read about the doctrines of grace in books like Chosen by God by R.C. Sproul or Jim Boyce's Whatever Happened to the Gospel of Grace, my whole framework and my whole way of thinking just changed, and I really, really wanted to dive into theology for all of those reasons. And one of the professors that came in the early 2000s to teach at our this extension center in Windsor was Michael Haken. And he came and taught an intensive course over a series of weekends on church history. And he started at the Reformation and worked his way through to the 20th century, ending with Lloyd-Jones. And I'll tell you, by the time I got through the end of that course, I was absolutely enamored with, Reformation history and the Puritans. And just from that time, I had really felt a desire to want to know more about them and to study them. But at the same time was serving in another local church and loving being with people and helping God's people, loving to preach. And I basically embarked on about a 10-year journey of trying to discern really what was my calling. And it was a very difficult time. In that interim, I got married to my wife, Vicki, We moved to Toronto, where I started to work with Michael Haken when he became principal of Toronto Baptist Seminary. So I worked with him for a number of years as his assistant, traveled with him, and got to see his piety and spirituality firsthand, which was really shaping. Got to experience his, you know, academic expertise in my life that really has shaped me also as a writer and a historian, and just pursued my education with really no idea what I was going to do coming out the other end of it. So it was hard, and I just basically tried one degree at a time and kept serving in the church and hoping that the Lord would lead and guide. And then the last couple of years, is through various providences, has led me to a point where I felt confident that the Lord was actually calling me to full-time academic life as a historian, and still with one foot firmly planted in the life of a church, like I'm doing now. I'm associate pastor, but really wanting to pursue writing and really wanting to pursue teaching, and so that's what I'm hoping to do.
Well, tell us something about the West Toronto Baptist Church, where you are now the associate pastor.
Yeah, it's one of the healthiest churches I've ever been in. It's I'm sitting in my office here right now, and just looking around and being so thankful to God that in His kindness He brought me here. When I first came to Toronto in about 2003, there weren't a lot of really, you know, overly solid churches. There's a handful of good churches and a number of good leaders. And I was studying and working at Toronto Baptist Seminary, and at the time, looking on the horizon around the city, there was just not a lot to really, put a lot of confidence in. And over the last more than 10 years, there's been a really encouraging movement of God's Spirit, where churches are being planted by solid pastors, where ministries are being started. I mean, every Power to Change ministry, which is CRU in the States, used to be Campus for Christ, on all of our campuses in Toronto, so at York and Ryerson and University of Toronto, all very solid. And other churches that were dying are being revived by good pastors. It's just been incredible to see. And part of that broader narrative of revitalization is West Toronto Baptist Church. It's a church that's part of the Fellowship of Evangelical Baptist Churches of Canada. It was founded in 1927, the same year that Toronto Baptist Seminary was started. So it was founded in the fundamentalist modernist controversies, which raged in Toronto because of a pastor at Jarvis Street Baptist Church named T.T. Shields. So our church was birthed in that crucible. When the current pastor, Justin Galati, first came 7 years ago, it was a church that had shrunken in size, but not in vitality. There was a good number of senior saints that were here. The pastor that was an older man had retired, and these senior saints knew that they wanted a younger man to come in with a young family to try to revitalize the church. It had a good standing. It's in the community. It had, you know, the resources to do things. And many of these people are retired pastors and retired missionaries who have a really, really strong sensibility for gospel work. And so Justin and I had gone to Toronto Baptist Seminary together, and when he graduated, he moved back to New York and was trying to discern a call. He'd been accepted to a THM at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, and just as he was about to go, he got a call from the search committee here at this church, and he just really felt the Lord pressing upon him that he needed to come back to Toronto, and so he did. And over the last 7 years, he has really brought this church from a period of revitalization to maybe in the last year or two, a place of real health. And it's been amazing because those senior saints have all stayed, and many now younger Christians are coming, young families. There's a real mix in terms of ethnic diversity, in terms of age demographics. And we just had our annual business meeting at the church yesterday, and it was just amazing now to see as pastors just how unified our church is and really wanting to do things for the gospel, not just in our neighborhood, but across the world. And so it's been amazing. And I've been involved in a church plant called New City Baptist in downtown Toronto. And another friend of mine had been pastoring a small Chinese church, and he asked me to help them. They were called Bridgeway Covenant Church. And he asked me to help them. They were kind of struggling, just mostly young people, about 20 people left, and asked to kind of give it one last kick at the can to see if we could make a go of it. And I just realized after about 6 months of sort of interim pastoring for them that, it would be a real blessing to another church if the 20 of us could just merge instead of closing down, really just shifting ourselves over to another church. And so through a period of searching out what church that might be, they decided that they want to merge with this one, West Toronto Baptist. And so we, about 3 or 4 years ago, all together, this Chinese church and myself, merged with West Toronto. And that was just part of a real boost for this church as an influx of younger people came all at once who were all solid, reformed, with a real gospel zeal. And it really did a lot to boost the energies of this church. And so I slowly came on to staff. And then once I kind of got to know the other people in the church and they felt confident in me, this past April I was ordained in our denomination and brought on as an associate pastor to work with Justin. So, yeah, it's just been such an incredible thing to see in God's providence how everything worked together. Instead of churches splitting, it was great to be able to see two churches actually come together. And I was really privileged to be a part of that.
Well, praise God for that. Yes, the church that I left when I moved to Pennsylvania, Grace Reformed Baptist Church of Long Island in Merrick, New York, that was a result of a merge also.
Oh, great.
Back in 1995, Calvary Baptist Church of Amityville, Long Island, which was a Reformed Baptist church that was busting through the walls because we were outgrowing the size of the facility that we had. There was a church about 25 minutes away, First Baptist Church of Merrick, Long Island, and that pastor had come to the doctrines of sovereign grace, but he had the opposite problem. He had a building that could hold close to 500 people. It only had about 20 people attending the church. So the pastors of both churches, got together and said, why don't we merge? And that's exactly what we did, and we became Grace Reformed Baptist Church of Long Island. And that was a church that I had been at since my conversion to Christ, going back to the Calvary Baptist Church of Amityville congregation in the mid-1980s, and just left there for the first time 4 years ago when I moved to Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So I know something about the blessings of mergers. And I want to make sure that I give the audience the website for West Toronto Baptist Church. If anybody is either listening who lives in Toronto and is looking for a church home, or if you're visiting Toronto, I know many people all over the United States and other parts of the world visit Toronto for various reasons, whether for vacation or business. But that website is WTBC for West Toronto Baptist Church. WTBC. Actually, it's WTB Church is a better way of saying it. WTB for West Toronto Baptist, and then church.com. And I hope that you do get eventually some visitors as a result. I also want to give Ian's personal website. It's Ian Hugh Clary. And he spells Ian, I-A-N, yep. And Hugh is H-U-G-H, Clary, C-L-A-R-Y, .wordpress.com. Yep. That's I-A-N, H-U-G-H, C-L-A-R-Y, .wordpress.com.
Thank you.
Well, now we come to the book that we have started addressing last Wednesday with Bob Smart, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival in the Reformed Tradition. And as I did with Bob, perhaps you could clarify the title, because people might wrongly think from that title that you are addressing in this book specifically the movement known as Pentecostalism, or the Pentecostal denominations like the Assembly of God, the Church of God, etc. But that is not the case. You're referring to the actual event in the scripture that is being used as an adjective, correct?
Exactly, yeah. We had long discussions about the title and what would best fit in terms of both being able to inform potential readers as to what, you know, this book is actually about, yet at the same time have something of a broader appeal than you know, just the Reformed tradition. And so we thought that there would be something that would catch people's eye, and even just in the title itself, kind of give a bit of teaching that, you know, there are other views of the Spirit, especially in Reformed theology, how that relates to things like revival. And, you know, I think that there are times where people might look at Reformed thinking and maybe, you know, and wrongly accuse it of not having a strong teaching of the Spirit. And so we wanted to, in all those ways, address those kinds of concerns. And so Pentecostal outpourings, you know, referencing sort of the analogy that we can find in Scripture, in Acts, is the repeated outpourings of the Spirit, and yet at the same time also with the subtitle wanting to emphasize the historical work, looking at how the Spirit has been poured out in history, specifically with various Reformed groups, both in North America and in the United Kingdom and Europe. So,
yes, and I've interviewed in the past a number of these authors on different subjects. Michael Haken has been a guest on this program several times, and I have interviewed Bob Smart, obviously, last week. I have interviewed Tom Nettles a number of times, particularly regarding things involving Calvinistic Baptists of history, obviously.
Yeah.
And Dr. Joel Beakey has been on the program many times.
Yeah.
I go back a long time with Dr. Beakey. I was the first person to get him seriously involved in attempting to launch a radio ministry, because the old denomination that he belonged to didn't believe in using radio.
Oh, really?
Yes, the Netherlands Reformed denomination, and
right.
One of the reasons he left that denomination, along with other members of that group, and formed the Heritage Netherlands Reformed denomination, which is more commonly known today as just the Heritage Reformed Church, but quite an impressive group of co-authors, and I hope to interview all of them eventually.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, let me speak for a moment to just to Dr. Beakey. He's a man that I have immense respect for.
Amen.
I remember being a younger Christian, just working with Dr. Haken at the very beginning of our professional working relationship together. And Dr. Haken, of course, teaches at Puritan Reformed Seminary. And so I had taken a trip with him while he did a week-long course on prayer, and really got to see Dr. Beakey firsthand. Here's a man that, you know, whose books I'm reading, and I have this sort of awe-filled respect for. And getting to go into his home and have dinner with him and his family, just seeing him as a family man, somebody who, you know, was serving us all, you know, meals, actually scooping food onto our plates, you know, going around the table and demonstrating this profound spirit, you know, servant spirit. And I've spent a number of on different occasions, spent time with him, and just been really struck at how humble and how gracious he is, and just the fact that he was willing to publish our book and that he's contributed to it, is a budding historian like I am.
Yeah, amen. And I can say, as a Reformed Baptist, that one of the things that I am very impressed by Dr. Beakey over is the fact that even though he is a paedo-Baptist, he has a very strong belief that children are a mission field. They're not to be taken for granted as if they are regenerate, born-again individuals just because they are the children of Christian parents. And that's one of the things that I really am impressed about him. And he's one of the finest preachers I've ever heard. In fact,
absolutely.
He came out back in the 90s to Grace Reformed Baptist Church at my invitation to speak at a Bible conference that we held there, and just really been enjoying his ministry for many years. In fact, I was very surprised, pleasantly surprised one day when I worked for WMCA Radio, 570 AM in New York, which is one of the affiliates of the largest Christian network, radio network in the world, Salem Communications. I remember being surprised one day when I was listening to the radio and I tuned on during the typical slot for Focus on the Family, which at the time was being hosted by Dr. James Dobson. And I'm hearing Dr. Beakey preaching. And I was like startled, pleasantly startled. I was like, I don't understand this. What, did Dr. Beakey somehow take over the Focus on the Family slot or something? And then at the end of the program, James Dobson, much to my surprise, said, and that was Dr. Joel Beakey, my wife's very favorite preacher. I was like, really?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say as well, to your earlier point about his view of infants, the other thing I appreciate about Dr. Beakey is that though there are certain, you know, corners in the Reformed world that of the Paedo-Baptist Reformed world that would look at Baptists and accuse us of not really truly being Reformed, you know, Dr. Beakey has not modeled that mentality. The fact that he has people like Michael Hagen speaking at PRTS, teaching there, you know, I think they have a very close relationship with other Baptists like Jeff Thomas in Wales.
Yes.
And you know, so you can maintain your convictions and your denominational distinctives while at the same time, you know, recognizing that the stream of Reformed theology is quite diverse, and that, you know, we Baptists are as much a part of that as you know, Netherlands or Heritage Netherlands Reformed or PCA or whomever else. So I that's another thing I'm really thankful for.
Yes, I've also gotten to really enjoy Dr. David Murray, who is on the faculty at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary, and actually have developed a friendship with him, and he really reached out to me in a very deeply meaningful way after my wife went home to the Lord back in 2011, and I just really cherish knowing him, and it's just good to see that the Lord is making these folks more well-known globally, and making use of them in far-reaching areas. And we are going to go to our first break right now. If you would like to join us on the air with a question for Ian Clary, it could be a general question on Reformed theology about his own testimony or church, but it could also primarily be about the book we are discussing, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival, and the Reformed Tradition, and even more specifically on the chapter that Dr. Clary contributed to the book, that's Melting the Ice of a Long Winter, Revival and Irish Descent. And we're going to be discussing that when we return from the break. Our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We will be right back with Dr. Ian H. Clary right after these messages from our sponsors. So don't go away.
Chris Arnzen here, and I can't wait to head down to Atlanta, Georgia. And here's my friend Dr. James White to tell you why.
Hi, I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. I hope you join me at the G3 Conference hosted by Pastor Josh Bice and Praise Mill Baptist Church at the Georgia International Convention Center in Atlanta, January 19th through the 21st, in celebration of the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. I'll be joined by Paul Washer, Steve Lawson, D.A. Carson, Vody Balcom, Conrad Mbewe, Phil Johnson, Rosaria Butterfield, Todd Friel, and a host of other speakers who are dedicated to the pillars of what G3 stands for, Gospel, Grace, and Glory. For more details, go to g3conference.com. That's g3conference.com.
Thanks, James. Make sure you greet me at the Iron Sharpens Iron exhibit booth while you're there.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, that's Providence Baptist Church, ma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen, and if you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours is Dr. Ian H. Clary, Research and Teaching Fellow for the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies, teacher at Redeemer University College, Heritage College and Seminary, and Munster Bible College, an associate pastor and elder at West Toronto Baptist Church. We're going to be addressing today part two of a theme we began last Wednesday with Bob Smart, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival and the Reformed Tradition, which is a book published by Reformation Heritage Books. And our guest today, Dr. Ian H. Clary, is one of the editors and contributing authors of the book. And if you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And, you know, before I go on to the subject at hand, I would like to know a little bit about the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies.
Well, the Andrew Fuller Center originally started here in Toronto under Dr. Haken, Michael Haken's leadership. It was originally entitled the Jonathan Edwards Center for Reformed Spirituality. And so my actual initial involvement with Dr. Haken before I worked with him at TBS was with this Edwards Center. And so for a number of years here in Toronto, we set up annual conferences, and we published a journal called Eusebia, and that dealt with issues predominantly in terms of church history. So I was an editor with him on that journal for this center. And when Dr. Haken, I believe it was around 2007, took a full-time position at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, though he still teaches here in Toronto at TBS. He's now full-time down there in Louisville. He took the center with him. I had gone on to pursue, to finish a Master of Theology and then a PhD. And so when he brought the Edwards Center to Kentucky, the name was changed to the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies. And one of the big reasons for that was Dr. Haken's own love for all things Andrew Fuller. So Andrew Fuller was a Baptist pastor and theologian in England in the 18th century. He was one of the catalysts for the modern missionary movement behind William Carey, who of course went to Serampore, India. So Fuller was involved with the Baptist Missionary Society as its secretary, traveling all over the UK, gaining support for the BMS while Carey and the others were there in India. And he was involved in denominational life. Revived what was then a dying Baptist denomination in England. They had really, for years, been suffering under the cold chill of hyper-Calvinism. And Fuller himself grew up under a hyper-Calvinist preacher, but then through various readings in the Reformed tradition, none the least the writings of Jonathan Edwards, came to understand the meaning of the free offer of the gospel. And that revolutionized his own life, his own ministry. And then as he partnered with what became men who became very close friends of his, like John Ryland Jr. and John Sutcliffe and Samuel Pierce, as well as William Carey, they basically lit the Baptist denomination on fire with the gospel. And so Fuller, was a denominational man, was a local church man, was a worldwide mission man. And he wrote a lot of very important works, not the least his book on the question of the free offer of the gospel and hyper-Calvinism, called The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptation, that came up two different editions in his lifetime. And so his works are collected in various editions. The most common one that we know of today is the three-volume Sprinkle Publications edition. Banner of Truth did a reprint in a single massive volume. There's also there's another five volume works out there, but the Andrew Fuller Center is involved in what's called the Andrew Fuller Works Project that is now doing a critical edition. I can't remember how many volumes it's gone to now, 15 or 17 volumes or something significant, but it'll be a critical edition of Fuller's works published under the general editorship of Michael Haken, with an advisory board that includes historians like Crawford Gribben in Ireland, Doug Sweeney at TEDS, John Coffey at the University of Leicester in England, and then various others who are doing individual volumes. So Crawford Gribben is doing Fuller's writings on the commentary on Revelation. We've got others including Tom Nettles, Stephen Holmes at St. Andrews, Jong Moo Yoo, who's in Korea, all doing critical editions of individual or sometimes collected volumes of Fuller's works, with scholarly introductions, about 50 pages, and then a critical text, based very much or modeled very much on the Yale edition of Edwards' work. So my personal involvement with the Andrew Fuller Center was maintained when it moved from Toronto to Louisville. I'm now one of the fellows and doing teaching on their behalf as well, so I'll do lecturing around on church history and Baptist history and Andrew Fuller, spirituality, those sorts of topics. And I'm also co-editing a number of the volumes. So myself, I'm working with Dr. Haken on Fuller's letters, I'm working with Stephen Holmes on Fuller's sermons, and I'm working on Fuller's Gospel, or sorry, his Genesis commentary with John Lu Yu. So it's a volumes have already been coming out now. Nathan Finn has his just come out. Michael McMullen had the Diary of Andrew Fuller come out, and they're published with a German publisher out of Berlin called Walter de Gruyter, which is a very highbrow secular academic press that's very kindly been putting and doing a very good job at putting these volumes out. So we're thrilled to be able to introduce Fuller to a broader and academic audience. And I hope that it'll have the same effect that the Yale edition has had for Jonathan Edwards throughout the 20th century. So,
yes, I remember the late Dr. John Gerstner being very, very excited about that Yale edition.
Yeah.
And I believe he lent his accolades to it when it came out. Not to derail the conversation from the intended subject, but Andrew Fuller is a bit of a controversial figure within Calvinistic Baptist history, as John Gill has been sometimes labeled as a hyper-Calvinist, although our mutual friend Dr. Tom Nettles disagrees with that. He believes that Gill is undeservedly receiving that description. Andrew Fuller sometimes is categorized as a hypo-Calvinist, kind of falling beneath the standard of what would historically be considered Calvinism. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, the big issue is in the later Fuller, and you see this in the distinction between the two editions of the Gospel worthy of all acceptation, but in that second edition, there seems to have been, and he's been accused of such, of a bit of a pivot. Especially when it comes to matters of the atonement and whether or not he adopted what is sometimes called a governmental view of the atonement. And so I'd mentioned that he was very influenced by the writings of Jonathan Edwards, and he was also very influenced by Edwards' disciples, the so-called New England theology that involved Samuel Hopkins, Joseph Bellamy, that... You know, they certainly, well, even then, in terms of scholarship, on that group, there's debate over as to what really were their views of Reformed theology and atonement and those kinds of things. So, the question is, how much did Edwards imbibe that New England theology, and to what degree does he or doesn't he stand within the Reformed tradition? So my personal take, and I'm actually contributing a chapter to a book on Andrew Fuller on this actual subject, I would argue that Fuller stands fairly squarely in the Reformed tradition. I think that even in his later work, I think he's critical at key points of certain of the New England theologians like Bellamy and Hopkins, even though he has immense respect for them. And that... on a sort of a different but related issue, as we are coming now to see at a deeper level the diversity in the Reformed tradition. So, you know, the scholarship of men like Richard Muller, Willem van Esselten, Drecht, who recently passed away, and others of that school, we're seeing a greater diversity. I can see how Andrew Fuller now fits more into a broader stream that still stands within the tradition that was kind of handed down to us from events like the Synod of Dort. So I would argue that Fuller stands squarely within what we might sometimes call Dortian Calvinism. I think that his view of the atonement is broader than somebody like a John Owen. But not so broad that it removes him outside of that. So I, you know, there's a friend of mine who's doing a PhD at Calvin under Richard Muller is doing a very important study on English hypothetical universalism, which was held by the so-called English delegation who went to Dort. That includes people like John Davenant, though he wasn't there. James Usher, whom I've studied at some length. Was a hypothetical universalist, so it's a particularism within Dort's parameters, but broader than the more stricter particular redemption view of somebody like John Owen. So I think Fuller fits within that paradigm and doesn't go into
And the website for the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies is andrewfullercenter.org, andrewfullercenter.org. And just for the benefit of our listeners who are either not Reformed or are young in the Reformed faith, the term hyper-Calvinism does not refer to somebody who adheres to the 5 points of Calvinism, right, as many people wrongly use that historic label. This is really in regard to a departure not only from historic Calvinism, but the Bible, in regard to how God uses human beings as a means to bring about the salvation of sinners. Isn't that really, in a nutshell, what hyper-Calvinism would involve?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it referred to as a sub-Calvinism, and, you know, I think that there's a strong argument to be made for that. I think that, you know, what I would identify myself as, and I think the best of our tradition as, is a sort of a warm evangelical Calvinism that emphasizes the sovereignty of God, the depravity of humans, sinful human beings, God's electing grace, his atoning work for his people, and his preservation and perseverance with his people. I don't think any of that teaching undercuts the need to openly share the gospel with everybody, to go about world mission. That was a big problem for Andrew Fuller in his day, as they're feeling this sense of call to go and share the gospel with the nations. For Carey to go to India, they received pushback, saying, "Well, God will save whomever He wants to save, and He doesn't need you," kind of thing.
Right.
I think that's horrific. And Fuller and Carey and Ryland and all those men had a very good understanding of God's sovereignty in salvation, and at the same time the need to go out and do the work of mission. A really helpful book, actually, on all this, on this subject, on the issue of Calvin and mission, but also as it's worked out in the tradition, is Michael Hagen's book. He did it with Jeff Robinson. And it was published with Crossway, and I think it's called something like Calvin and Mission.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, let me just see here. It's called "To the Ends of the Earth: Calvin's Missional Vision and Legacy," and it really is a sense of Calvin and the Reformed tradition on this subject. So,
well, I'll have to interview Dr. Haken on that.
Oh yeah, please do. It's a very important subject.
And well, let's get to your chapter in the book we are discussing today, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival, and the Reformed Tradition. Your specific chapter is Melting the Ice of a Long Winter, Revival and Irish Descent. If you could explain what period of church history you are describing.
Sure. Let me give a preface to this before we get into that. There's a big question in terms of doing church history, as to what constitutes the nature of revival, and theologians and historians have kind of helpfully distinguished between two ways of looking at the broad subject of revival by breaking it down into two categories of revival versus what we might call revivalism. So if you think of somebody like a Jonathan Edwards or a George Whitfield, you see, broadly speaking, what we would talk about as revival, the idea of a spontaneous work of the Spirit coming through the preaching of God's Word that revives the church, and then also with a stronger church sees the gospel going out and people being converted in large numbers. Whereas revivalism is something more along the lines of later development, though I think you see it also in the earlier periods, even in somebody like a Whitfield, but really strongly so in somebody like a Charles Grandison Finney, where there's this emphasis on means of, the anxious bench of prayer, not just like, there's a good way to use prayer, but then there's a manipulative way to pray in a manipulative sort of way to bring about revival, as though humans could actually twist the arm of God and make certain things happen if we just follow a program.
Right. And Charles Finney, I think that Jerry Johnson rightly described Charles Finney as a monergist, but not the good kind. He was a monergist in that he believed that it was only man that was involved in his regeneration.
That's actually a good way to put it. You're right. Well, that, with that preface in mind, then, what I'm doing when I'm looking at this question of revival and Irish descent is I'm kind of taking that broad paradigm of revival and revivalism and looking at that with earlier and later revivals in Ireland. So there are the two sort of major revivals that happened that Irish Protestants today tend to look back to are one that occurred in the 17th century known as the Six Mile Water Revival that happened in the north in and around Ulster, where you very much did see this idea of revival where people were going out, the gospel was being preached in all its fullness and clarity, and churches were being revived, and there was a remarkable movement of God's Spirit. And then the second one is part of the 1859 revival that occurred starting in New York, but then going across America and also across the Atlantic. And so that happened, the 59 revival, as well as in the north in Ireland, which had much more that revivalist mentality.
Is that the one that involved Jeremiah Lampfear in New York City?
Yeah, that one with Lampfear in New York City, yeah, and the sort of business men's revival or something like that, yeah. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at broadly at these two, revival and revivalism. I'm looking at how, you know, Six Mile Water is more an example of a genuine, what we would say is a genuine revival. Revivalism, the 59 revival, which both of them are important. I think God is working in both of them. Absolutely, but you see the elements of these two types of ways of looking at revival by comparing and contrasting them. And so I'm starting really in the 1600s and bringing it down to about the early 1860s.
Did, especially the first revival, did that include Roman Catholics coming in considerable numbers to the true faith of the Scriptures, or was it primarily dead Protestant churches that were being revived there?
Yeah, it was, in fact, both revivals were in the main to reviving Protestant churches, yeah, primarily. And in fact, the earlier revival, when it came to Roman Catholicism, there was some pushback against that. Then there's some, you know, absolutely brilliant stories Irish Roman Catholic friars coming to debate some of the leaders of the Six Mile Water Revival, only to have, you know, the debate shut down because you know, these Protestant theologians really knew their stuff.
Sounds like the boycott that was being held against James White for many years by Roman Catholics, but I'm very happy to announce that Catholic Answers is finally permitting one of their colleagues there to debate James in January 18th, the day before the G3 conference begins in Atlanta, Georgia. Trent Horn, who is a Roman Catholic apologist with Catholic Answers, has agreed to debate Dr. White on whether or not a Christian, a true born-again, regenerate Christian, can lose his or her salvation. So that's actually an issue that you'll have, ironically, many so-called Protestants siding with the Roman Catholics on that issue. But tell us about the genesis of the first Irish revival that you were speaking of.
Sure. The background to this all really has its roots in what we call the Irish Reformation. And so the Irish Reformation is a bit something that comes a bit later than the English Reformation. It's very different in many respects, whereas the English Reformation took deep root, with people like, bishops like Thomas Cranmer, Hugh Latimer, Nicholas Ridley, and still marks England and English Christianity today. In Ireland, it was very different. The revivals the Reformation came more in the early 17th century, and came primarily through the work of a man who I've always long had a deep interest in, Archbishop James Usher. Your readers or your hearers will probably know something of Usher in that he is the one who dated the creation of the world in 4004 BC in a famous Annals of the World that he wrote. And so Usher gets kind of dragged in a little bit into the debates over, you know, the age of the earth and creation and that kind of thing. But Usher himself was a remarkable historian and theologian and a remarkable churchman. He was one person, Crawford Gribben, is called an Irish Puritan, and I think he really was. And he's the one who is largely credited to bringing Protestant Reform theology to Ireland and trying to establish a Reformation there that largely failed, unfortunately. But within the context of this Irish Reformation, with this kind of rediscovering of the gospel, on a political level, there was the plantation of Scots Presbyterians in the north in Ulster, and through the sort of matrix of all of these things happening, you had preachers coming who were preaching the gospel, and people were hearing it, and they were being saved, and it came sort of in an unconventional way through the preaching of one man named James Glendinning, who was something of a pulpiteer. Was preaching in Ireland in the mid-1620s, around 1625. He'd come over. He'd been trained at St. Andrews University, and he was kind of your stereotypical hellfire brimstone preacher that preached all law, and God was using his preaching to bring the terrors of his law down on people's heads, but he wasn't then following that up with the life-giving balm of the gospel. And so people were in a terrified state. And so other men had come along, men like Robert Blair, also from Scotland, who'd been trained at Glasgow University. He'd come over and he came, and men like him were actually preaching the gospel. And so the people that had been under this, you know, feeling the condemnation of God's law, then all of a sudden hear the gospel, and then it becomes this overwhelming, sense of joy that was just spreading through the people that was really the catalyst for revival. So this man Crawford Gribben, who I mentioned earlier in one writing, spoke of how God used a madman like James Glendinning, who was a bit of a crazy man, to bring about revival. he had, this guy Glendinning had gone off after all we know about him in terms of history was that he had preached these hellfire sermons that were eventually used to spark this Six Mile Water revival. And then the others who saw something of his eccentricities kind of excluded him from the rest of the preaching. And he left to go in search of the seven churches in Asia Minor that you read about. So it's amazing the way God works.
Yeah. Well, we have to go to our second break now. If you'd like to join us on the air, we do have a few people waiting to have their questions asked and answered, and I thank you for your patience. But if you'd like to join them with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. That's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please include your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you live outside of the USA. We look forward to hearing from you, and we'll be back right after these messages with Dr. Ian H. Clary, so don't go away.
I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, and here's one of my favorite guests, Todd Friel, to tell you about a conference he and I are going to.
Hello, this is Todd Friel, host of Wretched Radio and Wretched TV, and occasional guest on Chris's show.
Iron. Criticizing Iron.
I think that's what it's called. Hoping that you can join Chris and me at the G3 conference in Atlanta, my new hometown. It is going to be a bang-up conference called the G3 conference, celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation with Paul Washer, Steve Lawson, D.A. Carson, Vody Baucom, Conrad and Bayway, Phil Johnson, James White, and a bunch of other people. We hope to see you there. Learn more at g3conference.com, g3conference.com.
Thanks, Todd, I think. See you at the Iron Sharpens Iron exhibitors booth.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation.
The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions, like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen. If you just tuned us in today, our guest today is Dr. Ian H. Clary, and we are discussing a book he contributed to, Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival in the Reformed Tradition, a subject which we began last Wednesday with another co-author and editor of this book, Dr. Robert Smart. And we are today speaking specifically on Melting the Ice of a Long Winter, Revival and Irish Descent, the chapter that our guest today, Dr. Ian H. Clary, contributed to the book. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And we do have a listener, CJ from Lindenhurst, Long Island, New York, who asks, I have become very fond of many of the preachers I have heard on sermon audio and elsewhere from within the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster and its sister organization or daughter organization, the Free Presbyterian Church of North America. Would you consider the genesis of this denomination in Northern Ireland a more modern result of a smaller revival of sorts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm familiar with the Free Presbyterians, obviously, with the late, oh, I'm drawing a blank, Ian Paisley.
Yeah.
And so Ian Paisley, obviously, a strong preacher as well as a strong political force in 20th century Ireland, especially in the north. But I don't know enough about its own denominational history to be able to draw back an organic link. I know for sure that Ian Paisley had a very high view, especially of the 59 revival. He wrote sort of an account of that and published an account of it, and would have seen himself standing squarely within the Reformed tradition. I know he had a very high view of men like Charles Spurgeon. But beyond that, I don't have that deep enough knowledge of that to be able to make an organic connection.
Well, I can say that from the men that I have grown to know, for instance, John Greer, who was for a while right here in Pennsylvania at the Malvern Free Presbyterian Church. He is now returned to Ulster. And I know that he is really a powerful, powerful preacher of the doctrines of grace, a fully committed Calvinist, and all of the men within that denomination I have met are fully committed Calvinists.
Yes.
The area that I depart with them is they adhere to different levels of King James exclusivism.
Right.
I've never met one that had a bizarre or crazy level of it, like some folks that I have met, but even our friend Dr. Joel Beakey, his denomination only uses the King James from their pulpits, but he would not call a heretic somebody that did not use that translation. But I really have a lot of wonderful things to say about that denomination, but I'm not enough of a historical expert to identify it with a revival. But it seems to be definitely drawing people in that area, which is known for apostasy and liberalism and even Catholicism, to a genuine understanding of the gospel and an abandonment of heretical neo-evangelicalism.
Oh, two quick things to that, both kind of related to what you're saying. I had picked up through my own, when I was ordained, my church gave me a copy of Dr. Beakey's study Bible that he did based on the King James with reformational notes. And I'll tell you, I've been using that with my family. I'm more of a, you know, ESV kind of guy. But I thought, you know, I really want to get back into using this King James version, and I've been using it over the past almost year to great benefit. I've been so delightfully surprised at how effective it's been in the life of my young children. The way that the King James reads has a real memorability to it. Second thing I wanted to mention was you mentioned John Greer. I believe John Greer, either his son or nephew or grandson or some, I'm not sure the exact relation, but as a friend of mine, actually, Peter Greer. Peter is working in Cork City in the south in Ireland with IFES, International Fellowship of Evangelical Students. And he's part of a larger and really remarkable work of God's Spirit that's actually going on, and we can talk about that later in the interview, in and around Cork City and in County Cork and in Kerry. And Peter is a great guy and is also himself very committed to the doctrine of grace. So.
Well, if it is the same Greer family, two E's, by the way, definitely tell Peter to say hello to John for me, and I'd love to get John on this program at some point in the near future.
I will, absolutely.
And, well, I'll pick up where we left off there as far as the history of this Irish descent, and specifically remind us why specifically you're using the term descent.
Sure. So with this Six Mile Water revival that happens in the 1620s, you know, the gospel is going out. I said that this is coming within the context of the Irish Reformation. And so the Reformation itself gets a lot of pushback not just from Roman Catholicism, but also because of the political nature of the English Church. So this is entering into the period of a man who became Archbishop of Canterbury named William Laud. And Laud was a very strong anti-Puritan. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to take what was then a very separate Church of Ireland led by Archbishop Usher. Laud wanted to subsume the Church of Ireland under the see or the bishopric of Canterbury. And so what he did was he sent political agents into Ireland. The most important one was Thomas Wentworth, who was the Lord Deputy, sort of Usher's political counterpart. And he was really trying to wrestle the Irish Church under English control. And that actually brought a lot of persecution. And that persecution was coming against also those men that were involved with the Six Mile Water Revival. There was an attempt to force them into a stronger conformity to things like the Book of Common Prayer and the English Articles of Faith. The Irish had their own Irish Articles that were very reformed, that actually formed the backbone of the Westminster Confession. And so with their resistance to further conformity, they were being persecuted. And so as this revival is going on, at the same time there's this degree of persecution that happens. And through that persecution, then you get the birthing of Irish dissent, so dissenting from conformity to the Church of England or the Church of Ireland and its formularies, and you get really the birth of Irish Presbyterianism. So I guess to your earlier question that came through the internet, there is a sense that anybody who would own a dissenting tradition in Ireland can trace their lineage back to the birthing here of Irish dissent in the Six Mile Water Revival and the persecution that came from that. So.
By the way, I think I forgot to mention to CJ that you have won a copy of the book today.
Oh, right on. Great.
CJ, so make sure you give us your full mailing address so that you can receive a copy of Pentecostal Outpourings, Revival and the Reformed Tradition, Compliments of the Publishers, Reformation Heritage Books. And it will be mailed to you by our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, CV for Cumberland Valley, BBS for Bible Book Service, .com. And we thank Todd and Patty Jennings at cvbbs.com for their faithful support of Iron Sharpens Iron. They mail out all of our winners in our listening audience their free Bibles, books, DVDs, CDs, and whatever else they're winning by submitting questions to our guests, and they do so practically on a daily basis, with some exception. And we thank them for that. And we also, again, of course, thank the publishers, Reformation Heritage Books, for providing these free books by our guest. And their website is heritagebooks.org. I'll make sure I mention that before we run out of time and I forget about it. heritagebooks.org. You're going to see a very long list of phenomenal books, not only that they publish, but that other Reformed publishers have brought into print. And I think you'll be very impressed with that ministry. And that was founded by a name we keep mentioning during this interview, Dr. Joel Beakey of Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We have Harrison in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, I have heard the word revival misused very often, especially amongst charismatic and Pentecostal groups and even amongst some fundamentalist Baptist groups, but if you could just give some basic elements of what you believe is an actual revival.
Sure. Well, that goes back to our earlier discussion about that distinction that we would make between revival and revivalism. I don't think it's a perfect, black and white, cut and dry distinction. Like anything in history, there's always complexities because in history you're dealing with people who are complex. But I think it's a good, broad, general category. And so when we're looking at modern, 20th and 21st century ideas of what revival is, it's often that kind of, in my own backyard, we had the Toronto Blessing, which is a very strong charismatic movement with Second Blessing and Gold Teeth and you know, gold dust falling down and speaking in tongues and divine healing and all this kind of stuff. And that kind of thing, I think, would fall more appropriately under that rubric of revivalism.
Also, apostasy would be a good label.
Well, and yes, in most respects, there's actually a blatant denial of the gospel as well, unfortunately. And that was certainly the case in manifestations of that up here in the heyday of the Toronto Blessing. We mentioned Charles Grandison Finney and that awakening that he was involved in with the idea that through your efforts and through the means that you use that you can actually bring God's Spirit down in revival. I think coming out of that are things like the Holiness Movement, and from the Holiness Movement then you get the Pentecostal Movement, and from the Pentecostal Movement you get various waves of the Charismatic Movement. And all of those you have to be careful to distinguish between. I have good Pentecostal friends and brothers that, though would believe in the continuance of the gifts, speaking in tongues, would look at the, you know, certain iterations of the Charismatic Movement, you know, very critically. So I don't want to put everybody all into the same category. But I think that you can see that more, you know, charismatic view of revival has having that kind of link back to a Finneyite type movement. That said, because there's a gray area here, and it's not a stark, you know, black and white distinction you can make, there's very much, I've studied George Whitfield in depth in my doctoral work, and there's definitely a sense, even in Whitfield, where, though of course he is preaching the gospel freely, and he is reformed in his approach to things, in the way he articulates the new birth, there is a sense where he is using means as well, and so I think there's lessons to be learned there too for us, where you know it is, you know, we're speaking through the media of radio that'll broadcast on the internet as well, and that's a means to a greater spiritual good of encouraging people. And Whitfield was really somebody who helped develop modern print media, and he did that for the sake of the revival and used it very effectively. Now he's not doing that in the same way as Finney. But you know, means are important too, and so you know, in our understanding of revival, we sort of got to take all of these things in together. But yeah, I think that this modern iteration is very problematic.
Now, would you say that means aspect would be a hallmark of the Calvinistic Methodist revival in Wales and other places?
Yeah, I mean, Whitfield is obviously very closely tied to that through somebody like a Howell Harris. And Howell Harris, you know, was a very strong preacher. But, you know, everywhere Whitfield went, and he had a strong connection to the Calvinistic Methodists in Wales, wherever he went, he used means effectively, and I think in a good way, like something like print media. Even, you know, Whitfield would admit to you know, even in his earlier ministry, as a young man, he would stir up controversy, you know, with his critiques of unconverted ministers, that he felt that though, you know, the content of the critiques were appropriate, the way he, as a young man, went about them, he was self-critical and said, look, I did this with a bit more of a bombastic nature than maybe I should have, and I wasn't always charitable. And part of that was a drive towards, you know, controversy begets celebrity in a sense, and Whitfield is certainly really the first modern celebrity, and he was effective that way. Even it would admit to inflating numbers of the crowds that would come, and so in later editions of his journals, he would bring those numbers back down to a more reasonable size and that kind of thing. So you can see that, you know, even in the earlier revival, you see it especially in John Wesley, way more so than in Whitfield. But again, I think that you have to always be able to maintain that revivalist distinction, and a big part of that is a really good understanding of the gospel and the fact that as Whitfield is preaching the gospel, people are being genuinely converted. As Jonathan Edwards is preaching the gospel, people are being converted, and those people remain converted. And you can actually see generations of people, of families, that can trace their Christian heritage back to the time of Edwards. Because the revival had such deep roots, whereas with Finney, you know, we talked about the burned-over district in places like upstate New York. where they would go through, you know, religious revivals just kind of burn through and burn people out, and people would get caught up in the excitement of it all. But it was not about the gospel. It was about other things, you know, the excitement, the charismatic phenomenon, whatever. And those revivals were not lasting, and that's part of the proof in the pudding, at least how I understand things.
Yes, but of course, you would have to admit that even genuine revivals, which will probably have more long-lasting effects than what Finney was involved in, still have historically seemingly died out, like the very congregation where Jonathan Edwards was a pastor is now a pro-homosexual congregationalist congregation. And, you know, there's been some horrible things that have happened in areas of the world and of this country. When I say this country, I'm obviously talking about the United States, since you're right, in Toronto. In North America, maybe a better way of putting it. But New England, which was obviously the place most well known for Puritanism in the 18th and 17th centuries, is now, as even secular individuals will be able to tell you, every election cycle, those are one of the most liberal areas in the face of the United States. So, and specifically in reference to the Irish revivals, what became of them? Would you say that there is still a strong remnant of that revival that has maintained throughout the centuries, or has it largely just fizzled away?
Well, I would think that what I do in this chapter as well, not only with, you know, the Six Mile Water that happens in the 17th century and then 1859, there are a series of smaller revivals that happened in the interim. So, you know, John Wesley spent a lot of time in Ireland. He had a real burden for the Irish and was preaching the gospel there, and there was a strong Methodist movement that was birthed out of that. And even we were talking earlier about Andrew Fuller. Fuller also had a really deep concern about the Baptists in Ireland, and that would go over. Samuel Pierce went over. Fuller went after him because they're, you know, the Baptists were planted in Ireland through the Cromwellian army that had come over in the 17th century. They started churches. The oldest one's actually a church that I have a deep relationship with, Cork Baptist Church in Cork City. It's one of the earliest Baptist churches founded in the 1650s. So there's been a strong Baptist movement there, and they all experienced, you know, degrees of revival at various points of time. And those look different depending on, you know, the nature of the preaching that it's involved. I think Fuller and Pierce are very strongly concerned about the denomination and are working on an ecclesiastical level, whereas a Wesley is going and preaching all over the place and setting up circuit riding and all that kind of thing. And so you can see in each of those movements different legacies coming out of it. And, you know, thinking about the Baptists, for instance, right now, since maybe sometime in the 1980s or so, there has been a real, I would call it, revival growth of Baptist churches in the South, which is remarkable. There's the denomination in Ireland there is the Baptist Union, and they've set up a thing called the Cork and Kerry Project, where there's a very intentional targeting of unreached communities with church planting, and it is amazing, absolutely amazing to see how many churches are growing up that are strong, reformed, Baptistic churches that are concerned about the gospel, that are just doing amazing work, even though the churches all have different personalities with their pastors. There's a real unity behind them, and I would say that's a legacy of what we saw, even with somebody like Fuller going over and devoting a lot of energy, even though it's a number of a couple hundred years ago. I think that there's a big part of that in what these people are doing. And I have a small part to play in that. I've been teaching at a place called Munster Bible College that meets at Cork Baptist Church. And, I taught an apologetics course. It was their first course that they ever ran a couple of years ago. and they had no idea what the student enrollment was going to be like. And, you know, like little colleges like this that just get their start usually have maybe 5 to 10 people as their first course that runs, and they had over 30. And they're going strong. They're training people for gospel ministry in all of these various churches. As the church planting is happening, they saw a real need for not only do we want to expand across Ireland, but we need to go deep and go deep with the truths of the gospel and our tradition. And so it's just exciting. and I see that as revival.
Praise God. By the way, how on earth did a college in the Republic of Ireland have the name Munster?
Well, Munster is interesting. I mean, you're probably thinking about Munster and what was going on with Martin Luther
Yes.
in Germany and the craziness that was involved with that Munster. But Munster in Ireland is one of the provinces. So you have Ulster, you have Munster, Leinster, and I think Connaught. Anybody who's Irish listening to me, and I got that wrong, I apologize. But so Munster is one of the provinces that has a series of counties in it, and one of those counties is County Cork, and so they really see themselves as targeting pastors and churches and lay people in the area of Munster. And so Munster Bible College is connected with Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. As we mentioned, Michael Haken a number of times in this interview, Dr. Haken has a very deep interest in Ireland, and so he set up this relationship between Munster Bible College and Southern so that you can take courses in Ireland and get credit at Southern Seminary for it towards a year. And now they're partnering with a couple of other schools that where you can finish out your education in Ireland with awesome professors. I mean, I don't mean myself in that, but you can have courses with Michael Haken and Stephen Wellham from Southern and Michael Thigpen, who is the president of the Evangelical Theological Society, has been out there. And a number of good professors are going, and they're getting a first-rate education on Irish soil and for the sake of Irish churches, and it's incredible. I love it.
Yeah, speaking of the connection with Michael Haken in Ireland, I am going to, God willing, be interviewing Dr. Haken in March of 2017 on Patrick of Ireland, His Life and Impact.
Great. Well, that's fantastic. A big part of my heart's in Ireland, and at any point when I can think of a way to encourage Irish Christians, I'm all in favor of that.
We have BB in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, are the Baptists in the Republic of Ireland that you speak of using the term Protestant to label themselves? I was wondering if that was an unnecessary stumbling block being in the heart of Roman Catholic Ireland.
That's a very interesting question, and a good question, actually. The Baptists there, a number of them, and I don't want to speak for all of them. First of all, the most delightful, easygoing people you'll ever meet, and just hospitable and charitable and loving. And I really connected with so many of the pastors and lay people there over the 3 times that I've been out so far to teach and speak for them. And so in terms of, you know, any of my foibles with the way I've described things, they've always been extremely gracious. So at one point I referred to us as Protestants. And some of those who had been converted out of Catholicism to the Baptist cause, Baptist expression of the gospel, in personal conversations, says, you know, we don't actually see ourselves as Protestants. For us, a Protestant is somebody who's an Anglican, a member of the Church of Ireland. And the Church of Ireland doesn't always have the greatest level of respect amongst some of them. And so they said, we're Baptists. That's our kind of core Christian identity beyond just being a Christian. Is that we're actually Baptists, and so that was an interesting experience for me because I self-identify as a Protestant, but that kind of comes with certain connotations. And they said that, you know, they view the world through in many respects Catholic eyes still. They don't have the theology, they don't practice the liturgy or any of that sort of thing. They believe in the gospel of justification by faith alone. They're Calvinists, but you know, they were raised a certain way and still view things in a certain way that I thought was very interesting and helpful. I thought in terms of, you know, ministering to their own native context, I thought that that's actually a good thing because it provides a bridge, a cultural bridge for gospel conversations that I think have probably gone to some way towards, you know, that growth of the gospel that we're seeing now. But there are many of them. There's been a great support from the Baptists in the north, in Ulster, Northern Ireland. A number of their pastors have come down to the south, and because you know, they've had training up in the north and come down, and they're planting churches as well. They're in positions of leadership. And so even amongst the differences that they may have, north and south, again, there's a real unity that I've been really humbled by to see. I'll make one sort of, I could go on and on about what's going on there, and you'll have to stop me, but I got one good story. I was there a number of Septembers ago. Every September, all the churches that have been planted all come together and have one big service where they, you know, they're in a large gymnasium, and there's hundreds and hundreds of them there where a number of the pastors will preach. And I have never sung "Be Thou My Vision" with so much heart as I have with those Irish saints.
I mean, wow.
Absolutely amazing. And I met this gentleman named Ted Kelly, who had come from the north. He was an older man now. He's probably in his late 80s. And years ago, he had come down from the north to do gospel missions work in the south. He'd gone to Cork Baptist. And I met this man standing in the midst of hundreds of Irish Christians talking to him about what it was like. And he said when he first went to Cork Baptist, there was hardly anybody in that church. And he would, you know, hear about an evangelical in a town miles and miles away, get on his bike to go meet that person to pray with them. And that was it. But through the faithful gospel ministry coming out of Cork Baptist, the church began to grow. As it grew to a certain size, well, they had a heart for church planting, so they would go, they'd target a certain town, they would plant a church there. Then that church would start to grow. Cork Baptist would continue to grow. Those two churches would then plant other churches strategically. And you had there's a core of about seven of these major churches that started, places like Carrigaline and Middleton and in Cork City, and just growing and growing. And so through the fruit of this older man's labors, you've got all of these hundreds of Irish Christians together worshiping God, and it was just a stunning experience to be with this man, and so humble and so gracious. But as I said, I could go on and on here, and we're supposed to be talking about a book. So,
well, I want to thank Bibi and the others who wrote in questions. You all have won a copy of the book, Pentecostal Outpourings. And just keep your eye open for a package from Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, and that should be coming in the mail to you within a week or so, and we thank you very much for participating in today's program. We're going to our final station break, so there'll be about 25 minutes more time to discuss this fascinating subject with Dr. Ian H. Clary. If you'd like to join us on the air as well with a question, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back after these messages with Dr. Ian H. Clary. So don't go away.
Chris Arnson here, and I can't wait to head down to Atlanta, Georgia. And here's my friend Dr. James White to tell you why.
Hi, I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. I hope you join me at the G3 Conference, hosted by Pastor Josh Bice and Praise Mill Baptist Church, at the Georgia International Convention Center in Atlanta, January 19th through the 21st, in celebration of the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. I'll be joined by Paul Washer, Steve Lawson, D.A. Carson, Vody Balcom, Conrad Mbewe, Phil Johnson, Rosaria Butterfield, Todd Friel, and a host of other speakers who are dedicated to the pillars of what G3 stands for, gospel, grace, and glory. For more details, go to g3conference.com. That's g3conference.com.
Thanks, James. Make sure you greet me at the Iron Sharpens Iron exhibit booth while you're there.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Paul Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivent Financial. We're not your typical financial services provider. We're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps our nearly 2.4 million members be wise with money. We provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most. We help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivent story by contacting me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life. Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689, 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnzen. If you just tuned us in, our guest today for the full 2 hours with about 25 minutes to go is Dr. Ian H. Clary, Research and Teaching Fellow at the Andrew Fuller Center for Baptist Studies, teacher at Redeemer University College, Heritage College and Seminary, and Munster Bible College, an associate pastor and elder at West Toronto Baptist Church. We have been discussing Pentecostal outpourings, revival, and the Reformed tradition, a subject we began last week with Bob Smart, who is a co-author of that same book and co-editor. And we are discussing the specific chapter that our guest contributed to that book today, involving the Irish descent and also the Irish revival. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. We have Jeff in Clinton Township, Michigan, who says, I'm very glad to hear about what's happening in Ireland. I wanted to mention the ministry in Scotland known as 20 Schemes and Pastor Mez McConnell. Are you aware of the kingdom work being done for Scotland's poor and if the churches in Ireland and Scotland are working together?
Yeah, very, very familiar with Mez McConnell and the work that he's doing there. The churches that I'm the circle of churches that I'm involved with here in Toronto have a close relationship with MES, and I know people who have actually gone from Toronto to go work with him there in, you know, inner cities in Scotland, and it's an amazing work. His own personal testimony is absolutely outstanding, and the close friends that I have that work with him have a very high view of MES McConnell's work. I don't know particularly whether or not Irish churches are involved with what he's doing there. I wouldn't be surprised if they are, knowing the close relationship between, especially in the north and Ulster, the churches there and the connection that they would have with churches in Scotland. But I'm not personally aware of anybody who's doing that work. But if any of my Irish friends were looking to get involved with it, I would definitely encourage them.
Well, thanks, Jeff, in Clinton Township, Michigan. You are also receiving a free copy of this book, Pentecostal Outpourings, Compliments of Reformation Heritage Books, and also compliments of our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, who will be shipping that out to you. And by the way, I would like either or both of you, meaning Jeff in Michigan and my guest, Ian Clary, I'd love to interview Mez, so if you could give me some contact information as soon as possible, I would love to follow up on that.
Absolutely, I can do that for you.
And our email address, once again, is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And we do have RJ in White Plains, New York, who wants to know what lessons can be learned by the church today from this Irish revival, both negative and positive.
Sorry, I just, interestingly enough, to your previous questioner, as it turns out, somebody in Ireland is actually listening to this and emailed me just now as that question was coming in saying, that Mez McConnell actually does have a relationship with the churches in the South and actually with some friends of mine. So just to give further clarification to that question, that email just came in to me. So.
Oh, great.
Sorry, I missed your question. So could you repeat that for me?
Sure. We have a question from RJ in Westchester County, New York, who says, what lessons can be learned by the modern church, both in a negative and positive sense, from the Irish revival?
Well, the Welsh revivals are pretty interesting to learn from as well, and we could go on because my wife is Welsh, and she, I'm sure, would want me to talk about that. But in terms of lessons from the Irish revivals, I think the biggest lesson for me personally is, you know, just as John Wesley said about Ireland, that God still has something to do with the Irish people, and so there is a great need even now. Though things are going so well in the areas around Cork, there's still a real need. And I know people even here that are going over and doing short-term missions trips. Southern Seminary sends students over to do those sorts of trips. So, I mean, if anybody is interested, please contact me, and I could definitely put you in touch with the right people about wanting to labor as these people have, you know, for so long in Ireland. I think the more sort of broader general lessons we could learn about revival itself. I think that what we spoke of earlier about the use of the preaching, the solid preaching of the gospel in the earlier revival in Six Mile Water is a real lesson. So if you're working through my chapter in my book and you read about somebody like Robert Blair, who was a Scot who came over and was preaching in the north there. He was a man who had very strong theological convictions, knew what he believed, had a very strong, powerful preaching of the gospel, and it was through the labors of men like him that churches were being revived, Christians were coming back to their faith, the gospel was going forward, and so there's a really great work there. And I think that, you know, as you continue on and you work and you get through to the 1859 revival, and you see how there's a marked change where the doctrinal content is lacking, and there is more of an emphasis on using means, and it brought about, you know, weird outcryings and strange manifestations supposedly of the spirit that ultimately were shown to be counterfeits. And so I think the big lesson there in comparing the two is to see that it is really through the preaching of the gospel. If we want to see revival happen, it's through the preaching of the gospel and prayer. And that's what I take away from it.
Now, how much of a stumbling block today is the times of troubles, as they are known, the deadly conflicts between Protestants and Catholics that seem to have largely dissipated more than a decade ago, but the memories obviously are still fresh in the hearts of probably the more older citizen in either Northern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland. How much of a stumbling block is the erroneous broad brushing of Bible-believing Christianity with political Protestantism and that which politically maintained or desired to maintain a strong relationship under the throne of England?
Yeah, there is definitely, in my experience with going both into the north and the south, there's definitely a difference between, Christians in the north and Christians in the south, and the way the culture, whether in the north or south, the unbelieving culture, respond to Christians. One of the a funny way, I remember once hearing a joke, the atheist Christopher Hitchens, who died a number of years ago, once told a story, I don't know if it's true or just a joke, but where, he was crossing over either from north to south or vice versa, and the border guard there, asked him and said, what are you, a Protestant or an atheist? And he says, a Protestant or a Catholic? And Christopher Hitchens says, well, neither, I'm an atheist. So the border guard goes back to his colleagues, and they confer amongst themselves and come back to the car and says, well, what kind of atheist are you? Are you a Catholic atheist or a Protestant? there's still something of a concern there, I think. But as I said, there's a unity, I think, between the Christians in the north and the south that transcends that divide to a large degree. And what's happening in the south especially is that with the breakdown of the stronghold of the Roman Catholic Church, there's actually a byproduct of that has been an openness to the gospel, because people have become so disenfranchised with Roman Catholicism that you could go and do door-to-door evangelism, and you walk up and you knock on the door of somebody's house in a town like Kinsale, and you say, I'd like to talk to you about Jesus Christ, and I'm from this Baptist church plant, and they're very interested to talk to you. Now, if you came up and you're a Roman Catholic, they'd shut the door in your face, but because you're, part of this different group that's not got all the baggage of however many hundred years of Catholic rule, there's a real openness to want to hear about what is it you actually believe, and that's part of how some of this work that's been going on down in the South is happening. The North, I don't have as strong a relationship with, so things would be a little bit different there. It's a different kind of Protestant religion there that's more conservative, even in its political outlook. I don't think that all of that has, the IRA and all that sort of stuff is obviously horrific, and I think that it has left a lasting memory for a lot of people, especially in the North. I've got friends there, and I won't share personal stories about them, but fairly harrowing stories that as much as they might feel that they're getting over things, that it's still very much there and very much reality. And I mean, it was just such a sad time. But I hope and pray that that's all done.
Well, I want to give a shout out to a couple of listeners of mine from the Republic of Ireland, Paul Flynn, who operates Megiddo Radio, and Megiddo Films. His website is megiddoradio.com, megiddoradio.com. And a listener by the name of Joe Riley, who regularly listens to Iron Sharpens Iron. It's been a while since I've actually gotten a question for a guest from Joe, but he does let me know very often that he's still listening, and so I want to give a shout out to him. And I know that we have quite a number of other listeners in Ireland and in the UK and in Australia and in New Zealand and all over the globe. So we just thank all of them very much for their encouragement, which I regularly receive via email. I want to make sure that before we run out of time, that you leave our listeners with what you most want etched on their hearts and minds before the program is over.
What I would like for them to have most etched on their minds, you mean?
Yes, you know, in summary, the most important things that you want etched in our listeners' minds today as a result of this topic, actually.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it really does. I mean, your listeners have probably heard, this coming through, but, the biggest thing is that if you're a listener and you're really thinking through missions and, you read about, say, my chapter here about Irish revival that goes back, I mean, like, one thing I forgot to mention was the Six Mile Water Revival actually has the prestigious distinction of being the first really reformed revival in history. And so there's a real legacy there in Ireland for the gospel, a legacy that's being captured upon, not just amongst the Baptists, but amongst other denominations too, and even other Baptist denominations. And so if you're trying to wrestle through a call and where should you go to do gospel work, I think that Ireland is a ripe field for mission, and that's something Ireland is deeply etched into my own heart, and I'd love to see that. But also within your own context, whether you're planning on doing any kind of missions work or not, to really use the right means of revival. We didn't talk about this, but in the chapter that Dr. Haken deals with in the book Pentecostal Outpouring, talks a lot about the prayer call and how we really need to be praying for revival, for pouring out of God's Spirit. And we can do that, whether it's for Ireland or for our own context. We're seeing that even in small measure in my own church here, where our church has really been growing, and there's a really strong emphasis on prayer in our church, whether that's praying in our services, praying in small groups, praying at prayer meetings, and those sort of things. And I think that God honors that as a good kind of means. And we need to be careful within our own churches to make sure that we don't use the inappropriate means of trying to, coerce people into belief that without the gospel and a solid theological foundation, you don't want to wind up like the fallout of a Finneyite type of revival. And so we need to long for revival. We need to pray for it. But we also need to be very careful that what we're doing is wanting the genuine thing, ultimately, to see the church grow and see God's name glorified.
Yeah, that's a fine line sometimes between a proper, passionate plea and urging for sinners to repent and come to Christ and the going over the biblical line of using psychological manipulation and so on. What is your advice on keeping one separate from the other? Obviously, we do not want to just give dry, dead, lifeless lectures to people about facts of the Bible and of the gospel. We want to passionately plead with them as our great heroes of the faith before us, and even some many present day heroes of the faith are known for. But at the same time, there is, even from some of our more modern Calvinistic brethren, perhaps within New Calvinism, are starting to use manipulative tactics during worship services that may be putting too much of an emphasis on psychology and so on. Not intentionally, obviously, but unconsciously.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about somebody like a Joel Beakey, and know, when we think of Dr. Beakey's preaching, whenever I've sat under it, there's a remarkable depth in terms of his handling of the text that he's preaching, the theology that undergirds that, and also a real experiment. You know, he would talk about experimental theology, a real sense of affection for God and for the gospel, for Jesus Christ, for the cross, that really comes across in his preaching. And I think to be really engaged, you're not just preaching theology here, but that you're preaching, you know, not just to people's minds, but to their hearts. And I think that is, you know, I think that goes, with that coupled with prayer, goes a very long way. And, you know, maybe we use PowerPoint or maybe we do this and that, but if we're relying on those things, it's not gonna do anything except maybe, you know, build up a little kind of cult following around a particular, you know, figure. But if we use, you know, the ordinary means of grace, the preaching of the gospel, the observing of the sacraments, the gathering of God's people on the Lord's Day, I think that goes much farther towards glorifying God and actually, you know, seeing the labors of that in the fruits of revival. Absolutely. Another thing I might mention, just as an aside, if people want to go a little bit deeper into this. You know, they've read a chapter, say they read this chapter on revival and Irish descent and learn about what's going on in the revivals in Ireland. A really helpful background book was one published by Evangelical Press, I think in 2003. I hope it's still in print, but it's written by my friend Crawford Gribben, who Crawford teaches at Queen's University in Belfast. And he wrote this popular little book that what gave me my love for Irish Christianity. It was called The Irish Puritans, James Ussher and the Reformation of the Church, and he goes through in much better detail, but in a very engaging manner, all the background issues, James Ussher, the Irish Reformation, and some of the lessons that we could learn from their successes and failures as well.
Well, praise God for that. Now, in regard to your prayer requests for Toronto and Canada in general, Canada is becoming more and more well-known for the way that they have started cracking down on faithful ministers of the gospel who are preaching out against the abomination of homosexuality and the abomination of sodomy's acceptance as something praiseworthy within churches. You know, they're being threatened with and even inflicted with fines and so on. Is that just as prevalent in Toronto as other parts of Canada, and what can we specifically pray for in that regard?
Well, I think even on a bigger issue, what's really happening in Canada and a lot, I think, in Western countries is a failure amongst, you know, citizens of respective countries of the value of the freedoms and liberties that we've enjoyed by living in, you know, the democracies that we have been, and I think that something that I'm very worried about in Canada, and it's happening here in Toronto, is the clawing back of freedom of speech issues, freedom of expression. I don't know if you've been following any of this stuff with Jordan Peterson, psychology professor at the University of Toronto, who's not willing to stand and be forced by the government to use certain language as it respects to gender pronouns. And I think whatever one might think about whether there's, you know, for the sake of a particular conversation with a person who might, you know, have gender identity issues or whatever, you know, I think we should all be able to, secular and Christian alike, come together and see, look, there's a real threat to freedoms here, especially freedom of speech, that if we don't actually make a stand here, we're going to lose out on a lot. And I think a big part of that will come with religious expression, preaching of the full counsel of God in the Bible, and those matters that, to me, just seem like they're right on the horizon, and Christians especially need to wake up to this. And I would definitely pray for Canada to remain a free country so that God's people can freely worship Him in the way that He demands.
Well, it's been such a joy interviewing you today, and I really look forward to you coming back often on Iron Sharpens Iron. I want to repeat a couple of the websites we gave out, heritagebooks.org, heritagebooks.org, that is for Reformation Heritage Books, the publisher of the book we were discussing today. If anybody wants to learn more about them and order some books of your own, We also have Ian Clary's own personal website, ianhughclary.wordpress.com, I-A-N-H-U-G-H-C-L-A-R-Y, .wordpress.com, and we have West Toronto Baptist Church, WTBChurch.com. WTBChurch.com. But anyway, thank you so much for being our guest today, and I want our listeners to always remember that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.